Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Justice Jane Bland of the Texas Supreme Court. Justice Bland, thank you so much. We really appreciate you doing this.
Delighted to be here.
We're also excited because this is another one of our in-person recordings. I think this is our third one in a row that we've done now in the last couple of weeks. We're here in Austin in mid-September. I was in for the Business Disputes course. Justice Bland gave the Supreme Court update, and she was gracious enough to come over to Todd's offices. So we're getting to hang out in Todd's Austin tech space that we have here.
Yeah, it has been really fun to be back together in person and record. We had to clarify before we started recording today that no, this isn't live on the air currently. It will take us a little time to produce the episode and put it out into the ether. But yes, this is Bland. We're so thankful to have you here and glad to have you visit our office briefly and look forward to visiting with you.
You make it easy. A block away from the court makes it easy.
Well, good. Well, I think most of our listeners know who you are, but maybe just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into law.
I grew up in Houston, and I'm the oldest of four children, three girls. And much later, my parents had a little brother who was born my first day of class at UT. I think we're a living testament to the fact that even though you might have 18-year gap in age, if you're raised by the same parents, you've got lots in common. So he's kind of a hipster millennial, and I'm just the very beginning of the Gen Xers, which makes it kind of fun. Anyway, I grew up in Houston, and in seventh grade, I went to a junior high speech and debate tournament and did extemporaneous speaking where they give you topics on a note card that you draw out of a hat. And you have 30 minutes to look at the time. We would clip articles out of things like Time Magazine and Newsweek, and they'd give you 30 minutes to prepare either a 3 or 5 minute speech. I can't remember. So I did that and I really liked it. Went to high school out in the Woodlands. They had a speech and debate team. And so I signed up to do it. And I think all along, I thought I might be a lawyer someday. My parents weren't so sure because, you know, lots can happen along the way. But they were very supportive when I went straight from college on to law school.
So no lawyers in your family then?
No lawyers in my family. And my sister married her college sweetheart who became a lawyer, but no siblings. And my two children, despite the fact that I have loved being a lawyer and so has my husband, apparently didn't do very well with our modeling because neither of our children are going to be lawyers. But that's great because they should have their own journey, their own adventure, and they're going to be great.
There are other aspects to life than the law, but the three of us agree, I think, that the law is a really good profession to be part of. But it sounds like maybe that experience with extemporaneous speaking in junior high did have a direct effect. Did you know, even going back then or through high school, that maybe you wanted to become a litigator?
I think I did. I didn't know what one was, but I came home, and this is before the speech tournament. Back then, back in the day, Monday Night Football, the commentator, the color commentator, was this guy named Howard Cosell, who kind of went down in ignominy. But at the time, he was the guy, and everybody loved to not like him. He was not, even at his zenith, he was somebody that everybody was like, oh, he drives me crazy. And it was the third or fourth grade at you boys in my class had called me Howard Cosell, and that was not a compliment. And I went home and told my dad. I was a little upset. And he said, my father said, well, one thing I know about Howard Cosell is before he was driving everyone crazy on Monday Night Football, he was a lawyer. So maybe you ought to be a lawyer. So he tried to make lemonade out of it, which is classic and true. It probably, I was chatty and a little bossy. And so probably those were skills that were great skills to have later on.
Absolutely.
But in college, I was in accounting. there was the fork in the road. Do you become a tax lawyer? And as I passed the CPA exam, why not? I thought tax law was really interesting, but just kept getting drawn toward litigation, probably just natural inclination more than anything.
Well, and you did a Fifth Circuit clerkship with kind of one of the legendary judges on the bench there. Tell us a little bit about that.
I clerked for Tom G., Thomas Gibbs G., on top of everything else. I think noted scholar, and his colleagues adored him when they weren't disagreeing with him. But even when they were disagreeing with him, and he could be a firebrand occasionally, he really loved his circuit colleagues, and in particular, the ones that he sometimes had strong disagreements with. But on top of all the great attributes he had for judging, humility and a talent for it and a passion for it, he also was a great boss. He was easy to work for and unstinting in his encouragement. I clerked for him the year that he sort of decided that he would go back to private practice. He had risen up to being the senior judge next to the chief judge, Charles Clark. He was not going to be chief judge. He was going to age out before he was chief judge. And I think he was ready for another challenge and decided to go back to private practice at the same time. I was trying to make my decision. And so together we went. So I got an extra couple few years with Judge G, which was wonderful. And he ultimately had Lou Gehrig's disease. And not only did he model terrific judging for me and how to be a terrific colleague, the true devotion he had to the work, but also he modeled the challenges that come with a disability like ALS and how you just forge ahead. And he didn't let it get him down.
Sounds like you had a great mentoring experience with him.
I did.
It went on for many years. That's a really special thing.
Not long enough, but yes, it went on for a few years. So. He was at our wedding, and I was very happy about that.
So. Sure. New Orleans stories? At least that you can share.
There are New Orleans stories, but they're not alcohol-fueled, except for my 50th birthday, which we are definitely not going to talk about. But way post-clerkship. But when I was a clerk, and my sister was in college, and she and her now husband, we all piled into my government rate hotel room because we all saw this as, you know, wait, we've got a hotel room in New Orleans and we're all broke. And of course, it's no big deal to share this tiny little hotel room with my sister and future brother-in-law, but we managed. So. But you know, I think it was a great experience. You have to remember it was a time before the internet, before cell phones, gathering in person for both the Fifth Circuit judges and the clerks was a really important event or happening for us. We geared up for the whole month to get ready for just those few days in New Orleans because the communication was really, Judge Chi talked on the phone every day to his colleagues, but other than that, there wasn't quite so much interaction between you and the other members of that are on the panel. It was a great time to get to know each other, to get to spend time together. The judges were incredibly gracious. They pretty much brought us all along when they went to dinner together. I kind of always thought sometimes you'd rather just go just you guys and not all of us. But I think young people liven up the place, and I realize that now.
Speaking as a judge,
now I'm on the other side.
So tell us about your experience in private practice once you left that clerkship. Did you wind up doing mostly trial practice, or was it a mix?
I came of age before the advent of specialization. The firm I was at Beckerbotts, didn't say, but it was really an unwritten rule. You couldn't be a partner in the trial department unless you tried cases. Even though I worked on a lot of appeals because I came over from the Fifth Circuit and Judge G and I worked together, that was never going to be a path, I thought. And at the time, I loved every day of the practice. I really never thought I would leave. I ended up doing a really great mix of trial work, a docket for the Farm Bureau. I worked on some HLMP cases. I worked on some cases for Texas City Refining, which is long gone, but someone owns the plant now. I hope they fixed it up. And then at the same time, I got to do a mix of appeals back then, oral argument. The rules didn't change, I think, until 97. The discovery rules 94 and the appellate rules in 97. So what that meant is that there were a lot of oral arguments to be had. You were willing to argue a case that was in the summer when everybody else wanted to be on vacation and out of Houston, or was a sure loser, or was in some special sitting like in Longview. It was a feast because, you know, if you didn't care, if you did your best and thought, I'm going to make the best argument I can, you would get a lot of experience. So ended up getting enough arguments and getting board certified in civil appellate and then civil trial later too.
Trial practice just kept pulling you back in, it sounds like.
No, I mean, you know, I think it's a great thing. I understand the need for specialization. And I talk to trial lawyers now that say, I'm never going into an appellate courtroom ever again. From the appellate lawyer's perspective, though, I always encourage young appellate lawyers, people who want to specialize in appellate work, to not foreclose trial opportunities. For one thing, you might really like it more than you know. Also, if you look at the business model, where's the growth in litigation? There's only so many appeals that are heard every day. There's a finite number of appellate courts, appellate jurisdictions. You don't want to be a person that is specializing in something that really is not going to give you enough work to do once you get. And trial judges and trial lawyers appreciate appellate practitioners who understand where they're coming from.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
We've talked about that on this podcast a lot, and we both agree with you completely. It's an important perspective to have because it's easy to kind of Monday morning quarterback the trial lawyers when you haven't been in their shoes until you've actually sat there and seen, okay, sometimes we just have to make split-second decisions, and maybe they're not the right decision, but it's the right decision at the time.
It also lets you get comfortable with risk in an appropriately measured way. You can't start arguing a bet the company appeal, right? Because it's just the risk involved in that kind of thing that can be daunting. It's daunting to anybody that argues that kind of a case.
Sure.
But if you start out trying a jury trial where the amount in controversy is something commensurate with your experience and your opposing counsel is similarly situated. When I started out, you know, I tried cases with law school classmates and people who became friends, and we were fighting about over back at the time, like, you know, $1,500 sometimes, or, you know, not even that. And we'd get it all resolved and then we'd go have lunch. And now those people are like in the American College of Trial Lawyers at the head of TTLA or a BODA. And you don't think of it at the time that you're building these skill sets. At the time, you're just, oh, I'm having fun. I'm going out trying this case that feels right for my experience level. And so that's what I think having trial practice gives you when you start out. But I will say that after me, it changed. There are people who from day one said, I want to be an appellate lawyer, and this is really where I want to specialize. And they have made great careers out of that specialization. There's lots of ways, as Justice Lehrman always says, and I quote her more than she even says it, but there's a lot of ways to get to Cincinnati. There are a lot of ways. It's in the middle of the country. There's a lot of ways to get to Cincinnati. But I encourage people just to try experiences if they're offered or asked for experiences. Mm-hmm. And you can try it and say, that is not for me. More likely, working for that person is not for me.
Right.
But if you don't try it, don't sort of challenge yourself to do something that's maybe not as comfortable.
Absolutely.
Well,
speaking of trying new things, while you were in private practice, you then moved on and became a trial judge in Harris County. Yeah. How was that?
I got on the trial bench at a great time in Harris County's judicial life. I was there with lots of terrific judges and lawyers. It was a relatively stable time in the judiciary. There had been a series of sweeps, and then the sweeps had kind of stopped for a while. And so we were able to recruit people who thought, I can really make a career doing this, even though I'll have to maybe close down a lucrative solo practice or come from a place where I was making more money, but it's public service and I think I can devote some time to it. And it attracted great people, and Harvey Brown, Pat Mizell, Chief Justice Tracy Christopher, John Wooldridge, who I saw this morning. Several of these people went on to become Texas Supreme Court judges long before I came up here. Dale Wainwright, David Medina, John Devine, Jeff Brown, all came from the Harris County trial bench. Yep. In and around the time I was there, I think Jeff Brown came shortly after I was there. Jennifer Elrod was on the trial bench. She went to the Fifth Circuit. It was a great time to be trying cases in Harris County. And of course, we have had some of the best lawyers on both sides of the docket trying terrific cases. So
that really is kind of an all-star list that you just rattled off.
I learned a ton from those people.
Going on the bench, once you started your career as a lawyer, was that something that you really aspire to do, or were you one of those that just left your stories about, well, it just kind of came to me, just worked out?
I think I'm more the latter. I never really thought about, even when I clerked and even working with Judge Chi after, I never really thought, oh, someday I might want to be a judge. Mm-hmm. For one thing, I didn't come from law. Someone in an offhand, Eric Nichols, who you guys know maybe, was a year older than me in law school. And, you know, he probably doesn't even remember this, but he was the editor in chief of the Law Review a year ahead of me. And kind of at the 11th hour, he passed me in the hallway one day and said, hey, are you thinking about clerking on the Fifth Circuit? I said, what? No, I don't really know anything about that. And he, oh, you ought to think about it. A lot of people do it. And that's really how I found out about clerking. If he hadn't mentioned that to me, I wouldn't have even known. And now it's a much more orchestrated process and the timing seems to always shift. And I'm pretty sure I would have been lost in the morass if I tried to do it today. But back then, it was that one comment from somebody who thought I might enjoy it that made me seek out what I needed to do and put my name in. And judging was kind of the same way. I was presenting a witness for deposition. I was a partner at the firm, and he was a resource witness, really not one that it wasn't contentious, which is why I was presenting him. And so anyway, we were at a break and he said, Governor Bush has this idea that, because there's been a lot of turnover on the Harris County bench, and he's got this idea that if we can put in some young people who don't mind taking a pay cut, they might be able to spend some time there and kind of grow into the role. I don't know that I did, but he said, so that are maybe around the same age. And so would you mind spreading the word? And I said, sure. Got home that night and thought about it and talked to my husband. And I said, well, maybe I'd like to do it. And that's really how it started. We'd had our first child, Daniel, and my husband's a transactional lawyer, never sees the inside of a courtroom and kind of does big energy transactions. At the time, the conventional wisdom, this is 1997, conventional wisdom is that the United States of America was going to be completely out of oil and gas by year 2020. His clients were kind of deploying resources around the world to try to secure access and rights to energy sources. And they were also working on all kinds of, it was a very beginning of exploring alternative energy like nuclear and geothermal and the very, very beginnings of wind and other things. He was traveling because, remember, no internet, no cell phones really yet, no real video conference technology like we have now. And so they would go send him places like Kazakhstan or Bangladesh nowhere glamorous.
Wow.
And for a while. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, you know, two of us, I need to look at. It was really more of a kind of being grounded in Harris County was extremely attractive to me. Mm-hmm. A seat came open a couple weeks later and I didn't get it. But a few months after that, Justice Medina got that one. And a few months later, another one came open. Governor Bush's office called and said, will you take it? At that point, I was 9 months pregnant with our daughter. It was basically Thanksgiving weekend. I was sworn in on December 5th informally and then had tried a car wreck case just to show everyone I was going to do it. I was going to do the job. And then had her on December 23rd.
Oh, my God.
And then, I'd immediately run to keep the seat. You know, did that. The 1998 election year, though, was a good year.
We've talked to a lot of judges, and I've known a lot of judges who have had to do that. But I've never known anyone who took the appointment when they were 9 months pregnant and then turned around and had to run with an infant in tow. That had to be a whole different level of challenge.
My husband was fond of saying short-term pain, long-term gain. So that's what he said when his they're offering it. He was out. He was gone. So the time difference with such that we usually talked about 8 o'clock at night. And I said, hey, you know, they gave me 24 hours. And he said, what do you think? I was like, well, sounds like a great job. And he's short-term pain, long-term gain. I look back on it as we do every time we go through some adversity. And, you know, my mom's really fond of saying, you know, failure is good for you. You just don't want to hear that while you're in the middle of the challenge or overcoming the failure or whatever it is. You don't want to hear it at the time. Right. But Sarah and I just went everywhere together. And I took her everywhere. And, you know, somebody would watch her in her little infant seat while I did my 1 minute. And then and Harris County at the time was big, but it's not as big as it is now. Mm-hmm. And we just took as a grand adventure. And she did take a little longer to sleep through the night. And I always thought it was because that was the quietest time for both of us. But I always used to say, oh, please, Sarah, please don't blame me if you really struggle as a teenager or ever. And I hope I'm doing a good enough job. But being the kind of kid she turned out to be, I didn't need to worry. And it had nothing to do with me or my ability. You know, she's just a great, great kid.
Oh, so that's great.
Anyway, she says she's not scarred.
It's always good when you're kid.
Yeah.
Well, so the trial bench, how long were you on the trial bench?
Just over 6 years.
Okay. And then you got promoted.
Yep.
In a manner of speaking.
Yep.
So what led you to the Court of Appeals in Houston?
It's hard to say, but I think I was more known as an appellate lawyer when I went on the trial bench. The appeals I'd worked on were higher profile for whatever reason, except for maybe a couple trials that didn't turn out so well anyway, and that's why they're well known. But they turned out great in terms of cultivating colleagues and providing great experience and great clients and all of it. You can't measure your career by a particular win or a particular loss, really. You know, that just happened also very quickly. The Governor Perry this time had in middle of December appointed Adele Hedges to be chief of the 14th court, and she'd been on the first court. And I think part of the consensus there, or not the consensus, the consideration was we need somebody who can turn around and get the signatures and get her name on the ballot immediately and do the job. You like to think that's the first consideration and not the political side of it. I haven't ever been in the room to know, but tap me like December 17th. I wasn't opposed that year. So it was nice. I got filed and then I didn't have an opponent.
It's like December.
It's a busy time.
December's not bad for me, mostly because of Sarah. For other reasons too, December hasn't been bad. It's all good.
It's kind of funny because when you were on the trial bench, you were in what is now the Court of Appeals. And then when you went to the Court of Appeals, you're over at South Texas, right?
Right. At South Texas until 2011, I worked on the restoration of the 1910 courthouse. Mm-hmm. And
it's beautiful now.
It is beautiful.
I love going over there. It's just such a neat, neat building. And the courtrooms are just gorgeous. And the attorney lounge probably doesn't get enough credit, but it's really pretty great too.
Right. Well, that was the old commissioner's court at the time. And so it got restored to its 1910 look. And it just made perfect sense, given that it was between the two courtrooms, to make that the attorney lounge, because the commissioner's court, graciously, they could have occupied the building with us, but they had kind of outgrown any use of that space. I mean, they couldn't fit their operation, even if they didn't move the appellate courts in there, they couldn't really fit their operation in there. And that courthouse is deed restricted to be a working courthouse. Mm-hmm. And I think the appellate courts were just very fortunate that our operations fit the footprint. Once you took it back to its 1910 architecture, that meant opening up lots of spaces and losing lots of workspaces. Mm-hmm. But now it's on Culture Map. It's one of the oldest buildings in Houston. It's not saying a lot because it's Houston, but it gets a lot of visitors. So it's nice.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
Well, it truly is wonderful to visit as an advocate. And the attorney lounge is pretty cool because you can go in there and they've got the CCTV piped in if there's another argument going on. Although whenever I'm there, I'm worried about my own argument. Yeah. Watching something else. All the features of it just taken together are so great.
It's so fun to distract yourself with anything when you're stressed out about whatever it is that's right in front of you. As my apartment was never cleaner than during finals. Classic. Oh, wait, I need to really scrub everything.
Well, you served on the Court of Appeals for a number of years, but your current job is you yet again were promoted in another manner of speaking.
Yeah.
Maybe you took a different path to get there than some.
Yeah, I was 15 years on the Court of Appeals, and in 2018 lost along with 450 other judges. I had really kind of thought that the ship had sailed. I had really thought that I was going to go back to private practice, which I enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And my children were off to college, out of college, and private practice didn't seem daunting because I was just naive. For the brief hot minute I was there, I really enjoyed it. And then, you know, turned out the ship turned back into the harbor like sometimes it does unexpectedly.
Was it in December?
No, it was August. But okay. Daniel was born in August.
Okay,
August,
well, there you August, go. Yeah, your kid's birthday too. Month. Yeah, good month. Yeah.
Point out, there was a little, were you back at Baker Bot?
This time, I went to Vincent & Elkins. Vincent. And Doug is there, he's been there his whole career. Mm-hmm. And the idea of if we're going to both do these jobs, and I had some idea of what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't it be great if we could do it in the same place? Mm-hmm. And we carpooled, we took the HOV. Once we figured it out, it took us a while to realize, oh, wait, we can take the HOV lane. The two of us. We do very different things, different mm-hmm. floors, and just for that time. And it probably wouldn't have worked, you know, early on in our marriage to both be at the same place, but it was really terrific. I enjoyed really every cool. minute of it.
But it didn't last.
It didn't last. And once again, Doug said, go for it when it came up. And that was kind of I had said, wouldn't go back to the Court of Appeals, but if this came available, and they said, oh, sure, absolutely. And of course, I think they were thinking, well, that's not going to happen. And I really wasn't either. And then it did. I've been fortunate to work with terrific people throughout my career.
And so how many years ago now? It was 2018 when you stepped off the bench.
Yeah. End of 2018. Yeah. So 2019, I was the point. Yeah. So I was really only gone a few months.
So we're back on the bench now as a justice on the Supreme Court of Texas. We really enjoy having Supreme Court, current and former Supreme Court justices mm-hmm. on our podcast because you just, first of all, we get to hear all these wonderful stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, really, you can edit out all of them.
Oh, no. They're not tuning in for Todd and me.
No, not at all. What was the adjustment, making the transition from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court? I'm sure you had some idea what you were getting into, but how did that work out?
I think I was ready for the challenge, but it was a challenge. It's not the same. The job is not the same as the Court of Appeals. What the two jobs have in common is the deliberative process that you go through mm-hmm. to reach the decision. You don't go it alone. You have mm-hmm. to, at the Court of Appeals, you have to have at least one other colleague and ideally two. At the Texas Supreme Court, you have to have at least five and ideally nine. As that consensus building happens with more people, it's sort of an exponential process in terms of time and thought in deciding a case. Two differences. One of the things, by the time the Supreme Court decides a cause that it has taken, it's lived with it for a while from the very beginning of the petition stage. And then you get the response. And then if three judges decide that briefing on the merits is warranted, we order briefs, and then four to grant, six to PC, or otherwise we have argument, and then we deliberate after argument, and then we deliberate over draft opinions. So it's a long iterative process in reaching a decision at the Texas Supreme Court. Court of Appeals, you don't really have that amount of time mm-hmm. with the case because you don't go through that first process of saying, should we decide this case? Because you decide every case. Mm-hmm. And then have the second, you're not conferring about the case when it's first filed, like you mm-hmm. like you do for any right. case in which we request a response. And then you'll confer ahead of argument, you'll confer after argument, you may confer on drafts. It doesn't kind of evolve over the time span that it does at the Supreme Court. And it's just harder to count to five than it is to count to two.
Absolutely.
So in a good way, right?
Right.
Because you're going to get, I mean, what you want is diversity and cognitive decision making. Mm-hmm. And I'm always really impressed. The approaches to problems and resolution of disputes or issues on appeal and the different takes that are all very valuable to the decision making process.
Well, then you also have to at the same time decide other cases if you're going to take them or not.
Right.
So that's a whole different
Yeah, every
process.
Week I kind of enjoy that. It's mm-hmm. like opening up a bunch of presents every week. What? Because you don't know anything about anything yet and you don't know what problems are lurking there. You just want to mm-hmm. open the petition yeah. and read it. And, you know, it's the first cut. The decision to whether to request a response or not, it's a decision in the grand scheme of all the decisions you make for a case that ultimately is taken and, mm-hmm. and decided by the court. It's the first tiny little piece of the decision.
When you open up a petition to read it, where's the first place that you go?
Statement of the case. Every time.
Okay.
Every time.
Do you like the table format that most people use, it seems?
Yes. In fact, when it's written narrative format, it doesn't help mm-hmm. because you're looking for some really specific things. What did the trial court do? What did the court of appeals do? And what's the posture? Is it a TCPA case? Is it a case judgment on a jury verdict? What is it?
Right.
And you're just trying to figure out what it is. And so the narrative form doesn't let you pull that information just like quickly. And what the table does is it helps you create an architecture mm-hmm. that then as you go through the rest of the petition, you can kind of weave into the architecture what the arguments are, what the real issues are in the case.
It's a great way to put that. I hadn't thought about it that way, but that's a great way to describe that.
You can glean so much information in just a few seconds.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what you're describing. Maybe it's not most, but the folks who do this a lot generally do put it in the table format.
Right. I think sometimes it's a narrative format because people want to add more explanation, either because they're worried about bumping up on the word count, or for some reason they think if I just give this bare bones statement of the case, the court isn't really going to get the right impression of what mm-hmm. is at stake here. So, and I understand that. I see that as a competing consideration, but I would just push back a little bit and say, well, by giving me the bare bones, you will help me understand the narrative to come and mm-hmm. where everything fits. It's harder for me to pull out those structural pieces or underpinnings in a narrative, but I can still do it. It's,
sure.
you know, I'm not saying if you filed someone out there filed their brief narrative format statement of case, I can still do it. It's no problem.
It's tough work. It sort of defeats the purpose in the petition practice. The idea is to not make the judges work any harder than they need to
right.
have that basic grasp, the basic understanding. Okay, good. I'm glad to hear you say that because I'm a table guy.
Same.
Myself.
But one thing I wanted to talk about, a theme that has kind of come up here, one of your liaison assignments is to the Mental Health Commission. Can you kind
yes.
of talk about what they do and
sure.
you know, what the court's role is and all that?
Sure. So the Judicial Commission on Mental Health was started in 2018. It had been up and running about 6 months when I got there. And Jeff Brown had been the liaison, the initial liaison. So it was a natural, I think, continuation that since I came in to his seat, that I was the liaison. It's a joint project with the Court of Criminal Appeals. It really was founded with the understanding that there is a lot of intersection of the justice system with people who have mental health challenges. Mm-hmm. And how do we serve those people and make engagement with the justice system? How do we improve engagement with the justice system for those people? Not just mental illness, but also people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And what we really work on are kind of three areas. One is to educate, basically to train judges and others about mental illness and ways to help people who are encountering the justice system that have one of those challenges. And we collaborate with lots of other stakeholders. So we had an all-day meeting yesterday. And on our commission, we have mental health care providers, physicians, law enforcement, district attorney's offices, public defenders, trial court judges, appellate court judges, all with sort of the aim of looking at the problems that people with mental illness face in connection with the justice system. So our mission is really to ease the way. And we do that by piloting programs at their mental health courts in a number of Texas counties now. They're similar to drug courts and veterans courts. We are doing, it's called SIM mapping. There's something called the sequential intercept model that talks about sort of pre-law enforcement, someone with mental illness, even before there's some engagement with law enforcement, how do we divert that and provide outpatient restoration services? What other kind of services, not restoration services, but outpatient services that could potentially avoid encounters with law enforcement? But then when law enforcement is called, what are the best practices for assisting that person with treatment, protecting public safety, and sort of that continuum? Then you move on to what does it look like when someone is then in front of a probate court or perhaps or a criminal court? And what do we do in terms of services, medication, and then can go on down the line to incarceration, release? And so there's all these various stages. And how do we collaborate with mental health authorities, healthcare providers, and others along the way to see that these people are given the best opportunity to be well and to succeed at whatever point in the process they're in? So that's kind of what that does. I've learned a lot. I'm a navigator of lots of really bright minds who are experts in this field. We put together legislative proposals that get vetted by the continuum of stakeholders who reach consensus on ways that we can improve. We help improve forms for emergency detention so that if a family member is on the internet looking for a way to have a four-hour hold, they can pull up the form, fill it out, and know that, you know, if they fill it out, it's likely to be accepted in terms if it has merit and it's not going to be rejected for a technical reason, for example. Those are just a couple of things.
Well, it's really important work. And I mean, the way you rattled off all the different things, the different components of that, I mean, you've obviously gotten educated.
It's important. Hats off to Judge Barbara Hervey, who's co-chair at the Court of Criminal Appeals. Mm-hmm. It's very rewarding work. I learned more about what it looks like in juvenile court when a child who has had issues struggling, and we all know from the pandemic that it's a very important topic right now in our society's discussion writ large. And it's great that the two courts got ahead of it a little bit to create this structure for the exchange of ideas and improvements. There's a lot of improvement that can be made. There's some
low-hanging fruit. And well, you're also involved with the Texas Supreme Court Historical Society.
Yeah. Judicial Commission on Mental Health is modern and a little bit messy in a good way because there's just lots of different constituencies and sometimes there's not always total agreement about the best path forward. It's amazing how when we sit down and talk, how we can often find consensus about what that path looks like. Texas Supreme Court Historical Society, the history buffs of our state, happy to be their liaison and learn a lot about our state's history and in particular the court's history. Mm-hmm. It's a well-oiled machine.
It really is. Especially now that a friend of our podcast, Justice Ken Wise, is in charge of it. I'm sure it's going to be even more
well-oiled. You're right. Just sworn in as president. Yeah. We had Cynthia Timms and we had Tom Leatherbury. And so I've had all-star leaders to work with. It's been great.
I have to poke at you a little bit.
What
now.
Did I do wrong? Okay.
No, it's not wrong at all. It was actually quite perfect when you were swore in, Justice Wise, I believe.
As the incoming president.
As the incoming president. And you had a great one-liner as you did that. It had something to do with your last name. Want to repeat that for us?
Well, I mean, as they say, the name says it all, right? And so for him, Wise, I mean, that's a great, if it's that says it all. And he is a wise person, and he's in particular extremely wise and knowledgeable about history. We're really lucky.
Wise about Texas.
He is wise about Texas. But, you know, what does that say for me? Because my last name is Bland. If your name doesn't say it all, you kind of spend some time trying to make sure everyone knows it doesn't. I don't know.
I understand.
My husband is not Bland.
Well, neither are you. Anyone listening to this podcast can tell that that's not true.
That's right. You got an audible laugh.
You did. Yeah.
Well, I just...
Because Jody and I were both there.
It wasn't pre-arranged. It was just, why is he so wide?
No, I think that's really great. You were worried about being able to fill time today, and we're actually doing quite well with keeping going on really interesting topics of conversation. We want to make sure we cover a few other things before we let you go. You're in a unique position, given the benches that you've sat on, to seeing advocacy at those three levels. And I'm sure a lot of really good advocacy and probably a lot of really bad advocacy too. Is there any overarching theme that comes to mind for you, just having spent time at the three different levels of our court system in Texas? And would you share that with us?
Sure. And I really thought this starting at the trial bench and ever since, that first of all, if there is a lawyer that happens to be listening to this, you are a better lawyer than you think you are. And as I sometimes say to an audience of lawyers, for some of you, that's a high bar because you already think you're pretty good. But I think, you know, lawyers can be hard on themselves. Sure. And in my experience, more often than not, the ability of the lawyer is commensurate with the complexity of the case and the issues that are there. Most of the time, things are a good fit. It's really hard, I think, when there's a real mismatch. It's hard on the judge. It's hard on the lawyer. It's hard on the opposing counsel who may not maybe have, whose skill set does match the case. I think it can be hard, but I would say that that's pretty rare. So I would just tell lawyers, keep at it. It's practice and you're fine. And good advocacy comes with experience. It comes with hard work. We're all better at what we do if we prepared adequately. And I've seen some very good lawyers that I know are good lawyers, and I've seen perform really well. And maybe they just didn't have quite the time to get ready on the case, or they were hired at the 11th hour or something like that. And it's not as good. So you kind of play the hand you're dealt.
That is true sometimes, especially at those 11th hour, coming in to argue a jury charge you've never seen before. Just one example, but not that I'm making excuses for anybody.
And it's never a bad thing to let a younger lawyer who has had more time to prepare, to give that person the chance to make the argument, because you don't have to make a big deal about it, because everyone everyone in the trial court will know when the young person steps up and the other person is to the side watching what's going on.
Right.
So you don't have to say, well, I've agreed to let so-and-so, my associate, argue. Just do it. And they're going to do a great job because they know it. For them, it's like, for you, it may be your 1,000th hearing in district court, but for them, it's their first or second or fifth. It's everything. So they're going to do a good job.
Absolutely. One thing I want to ask you about, and this was not on our topic list,
but it's
a great gig. And I know sometimes we have law students that listen. Would you just tell a little bit about kind of what role they serve and how you can get to be one if you want to apply?
It's typical of other clerkships in that it involves a lot of research and writing, opinion writing, study memos and other written assignments that the judge may give you to try to suss out issues in a case. That's typical at any level. I think the one distinguishing factor at the Texas Supreme Court is this unusual traditional practice at the court that every law clerk and lawyer sits in on conference and so gets to hear the discussion of the cases by the nine judges. And sometimes every once in a while is called on to talk about a case that they may have particular knowledge about. And that's unusual. That wasn't the case at the Fifth Circuit. I don't think it is now, and I don't think it's the case, the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's pretty enlightening, I think, for people right out of law school to hear just sort of the caliber of the discussion, the range of legal matters that kind of percolate throughout the state, and then the various approaches to persuading your colleagues, which there's lots of different ways to persuade. And you can kind of see nine different personalities and say, well, ask yourself, well, that might work for me, or maybe not.
If they want to
apply, we just started the 22 term. I've hired one clerk for 23, 24, but I haven't filled my clerk's class. And I think there are several other judges that haven't either. So it's not too late. I say that to everybody who was like me that really didn't think about clerking until somebody kind of said maybe it would be a good idea. You just send an application to the Texas Supreme Court. Usually there's a cover letter, a writing sample, and recommendations from a couple of professors. It's important to show a skill at writing because that's a big part of the job. It's not a big part of all legal jobs, but it's a big part of this one. That is not something that you have an aptitude for, or you've shown some demonstrated interest in. It's probably not the right job for you. And then obviously we look at grades and all of that too.
It's not every day we have someone with your experience at the three levels. Again, just to come back to that for just another minute, I do want to ask you, while we've got you, as you sort of suggested earlier in the conversation, there's far more to appellate practice than just sitting behind the computer and writing briefs. I mean, good appellate lawyers, I'd like to think, find themselves in trial courts not infrequently. What do you think are some of the ways that appellate counsel can be most effective in, say, trial courts? Because we kind of know what we do in courts of appeals in the Supreme Court. What advice would you give, I'd say, even trial lawyers? Because we try to address that audience in the show in terms of the use of appellate counsel in trial courts.
My advice to appellate lawyers who appear in the trial courts is have some familiarity with what has happened in the trial so that when you come in to argue the charge, or if you're going to argue a doe-bear motion or whatever it is, you're not siloed. You're well aware of what else is going on. Maybe you haven't been there every day, but you know what's going on. So you're meeting with the trial team at the end of the day or have some way of keeping up to speed. Then I would look at ways to really facilitate improving the trial. And by that, appeals are expensive and time-consuming. Clients don't want them. Judges don't want them. You know, a jury would be not happy to hear that their whole time would have been wasted because of an error that the judge made. How do you do that? Well, if you're in a defamation case and your case involves a public figure, you're going to have New York Times versus Sullivan to hand to the trial judge, educate the judge about the issue of actual malice and ask the judge to submit it and explain why. And the judge may ultimately say no, and you've got your record at the charge conference. At the same time, you've given the judge the tools to make a really informed decision about whether or not to submit a particular instruction. I also think that works with opposing lawyers. If you're a plaintiff and you're working on the jury charge in the plaintiff's case, and the defense lawyer is asking for a particular, and the one that comes to mind, an instruction on proximate cause or producing cause, and they're saying, this is the one you need to have. I mean, maybe they guessed at Ford Motor Company versus Ledesma or something like that. They were pushing that. And you have to ask yourself, if you're on the plaintiff's side, is the jury going to hang up on a slight variation in the definition of causation that would really harm my trial lawyer's ability to win this case? If the answer is no, think about saying, yeah, sure, I'll put it in the charge. I mean, really, you have to really work with the trial lawyer to find out, is this instruction going to kill our case? And then ask yourself, if it won't, maybe you don't want to give the other side that bullet on appeal. And you always have to ask yourself and evaluate whatever it is you're advising in the trial court. Is this error that's about to be made that I'm going to try to preserve, is it harmful? And what am I going to let go? As somebody jumping up and protecting the record all the time, at some point they become sound like a broken record and trial judge starts to tune the person out. And the trial judge will definitely start tuning out the person who says, well, judge, I'm going to reverse you. They've heard that and they've learned that no, probably not. If you're an appellate lawyer, don't do that.
That's a great bit of advice, but it is. We are at the time we had scheduled for today, and it's been such a great conversation with the judge. Our tradition is to allow our guests to offer a tip or a war story to kind of cap off the conversation. Did you have something else in mind we've already talked about?
Just at the Supreme Court, and this is a technical tip, it has nothing to do with advocacy. It is get good at bookmarking, because the first thing I do is like click on those bookmarks. And if you have a bookmark, again, not a big deal, scroll to find whatever it is I'm looking for, but you sure make it easy on the judge. The other thing is, if you're in the Supreme Court's requested briefing on the merits, consider attaching the Court of Appeals opinion and other super relevant appendices to your briefing on the merits, so they don't have to click back to either the record or the petition for review or the response to the petition for review to find what they're looking for if it's something that you're talking about a lot in your briefing on the merits. Those are my two just total.
Those are great, though.
That's perfect. Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.